The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's good to be back on a Thursday. I see some familiar faces. Tonight I want to speak about a topic that is not terribly popular. It's up there with renunciation. The topic is surrender. And I hope with this talk I can invite you to look at this topic from different angles and get a different sense for this term. One of the things that I appreciate very much about this practice is that it invites us to take a fresh look at terms like renunciation, where we have this very negative association of, I have to deprive myself of something. When we look at it from the Dharma perspective, we discover that renunciation is actually giving up a small joy for a larger one. It sounds better, doesn't it? So let us look at surrender from a few different angles. The first association I have with surrender. I was about 6 years old, and I thought it was much more interesting to be a boy than a girl. And I thought it was very simple that if I just announced that I was a boy, that took care of the whole thing. So I just started announcing that I was now a boy. So I went to announce it to a cousin of mine who was about 2 years older than me. And his answer really surprised me. He mockingly answered, "Oh yeah? Well, prove it. Let's have a fist fight." Well, I didn't have a whole lot of experience with fist fights, so in no time he had me flat on the ground, face down, my arm twisted on my back, and he kept twisting. He said, "I won't let you go until you say, 'I'm not a boy, I surrender.'" So he was bigger than me. There was no way I was going to be able to free myself. So once I figured that out, between sobs, I stammered, "I give up. I'm not a boy. I surrender." So in this kind of surrender, we can see that you have the sense of defeat. I was subjugated at that point. There was a sense of separation from the other. And I would guess that most of us begin with this kind of meaning for this term. So I was particularly puzzled when quite a few years ago in my first long residential retreat, somewhere in the middle, out of nowhere these words came into my mind where I clearly heard, "I surrender." So I was kind of surprised and said, "What is this all about? What am I supposed to surrender to?" And this is exactly what I want to look at. I started by looking at the linguistic roots of surrender and found out that it comes from the Old French with a prefix sur, which means over, and rendre, which means to return, to give back. So that's an interesting combination of two words. So what it suggests to me is that we're giving back something that's not of no use of us anymore. We're going beyond, over and beyond the controlling mind. Now, not all forms of surrendering are momentous. I think we all practice various forms of surrendering in our daily lives. For example, there's a small surrendering that happens between being awake and going to sleep. It's interesting if you pay attention that we actually say fall asleep, or falling asleep. The word to fall, you know, implies that we're giving up control, even if it's for a moment. We need to give up control in order to move into sleep. And we've all had the experience of not being able to fall asleep. It's something that we are hanging on. The body feels tense when we're often, right, when we're not being able to fall asleep. I find it interesting that when we talk about falling in love, we again find the term to fall. Paul Coelho writes, "Reason lost the battle, and all I could do was surrender and accept I was in love." So we know that blissful time, even if for us sometimes it lasts moments, when we don't control things. Some of you might be familiar with a French expression that I find quite interesting. That is, says, le petit mort, the small death. And it's I find it very interesting to have this expression referring to sexual intimacy, you know, that moment of being able to let go of control. So it's this surrendering that happens where for a moment we transcend this illusion that we are separate, and then we're able to connect with a powerful life force. So this process of opening up to another is being able to be with fear. Dharmically speaking, this is a very fruitful stage. Here we can practice not ignoring our fear or repressing it or avoiding it. Found it very interesting that the researcher Brené Brown, I don't know if you know about her, she has devoted her whole life to researching vulnerability and shame. Imagine those two areas. And after many years of study, doing interviews, this is the way that she writes about love. She says, "We cultivate love when we allow our most vulnerable and powerful selves to be deeply seen and known. And when we honor the spiritual connection that grows from that offering with trust, respect, kindness, and affection." The most radical surrendering that we encounter in our lives is, of course, the moment of our death. So I think even up till now, you can see that we're bringing about different meanings to surrendering. It has nothing to do with weakness, but with courage. It has nothing to do with defeat, but with transcendence and liberation. I want to share with you a story that I heard from Frank Ostaszewski, who is a Zen co-founder of Zen Hospice. Frank tells the story of his friend, a very dear friend of his, who was dying of AIDS. And he was with him in the hospital in his last few days. This one particular night, his friend was in very, very bad shape. He had an acute diarrhea. He was so weak that Frank had to help him out of the bed, almost carry him onto the commode, and sometimes even to the bathtub in order to help him get cleaned and back to the bed. This went on for hours through the night. His friend was so weak that he couldn't speak anymore. But at some point, he gathered all his strength, looked at Frank in the eye, and said, "Frank, you're trying too hard." Those words for Frank were like lightning in a dark night. Just all at once, he was able to see the reality of the vulnerability of our human existence, of the sadness of not being able to help his friend, of his own mortality and the mortality of his friend. So this was a moment of surrendering for Frank, a relinquishing control over those realities that we can't possibly avoid. So the two friends just sat together and cried. So unlike my first association with surrendering, here was no shame, no subjugation, no separation. Here was acceptance, compassion, tenderness, and connectedness. So it was a profoundly intimate moment for both men. His friend died just a few days later. And think for a moment what an amazing gift he was able to give his friend, the gift of holding together his suffering, his pain. And if we consider if Frank had answered like we would most like most of the time answer, "Oh, no, no, it's fine, I can handle it." Sometimes it's okay to answer that, but in that particular moment, I think he would have wasted a precious opportunity to embrace his friend and the reality. Eckhart Tolle writes, "Always say yes to the present moment. What could be more futile, more insane, than to create inner resistance to what already is? What could be more insane than to oppose life itself, which is now and always now? Surrender to what is, say yes to life, and see how life suddenly starts working for you rather than against you." So now I want to look specifically at surrender within the practice. And I want to go back to the question that I started with. How does surrendering look like in the practice, and what are we surrendering to? So I want to investigate this question through one of the Buddha's discourses. This is the Sona Sutta. It is about a monk named Sona, who was very earnest about practicing. He had a rather genteel upbringing, and he really applied himself earnestly in his practice. He especially took to walking meditation. He walked barefoot on this path that had a lot of pebbles until his delicate skin and his soles of his feet were cut open and bleeding. And at that moment of suffering, doubt arose in him. And I quote, "Of the blessed ones, disciples who have aroused their persistence, I am one, but my mind is not released from the fermentations through the absence of clinging. Now my family has enough wealth that it would be possible to enjoy wealth and make merit. What if I were to disavow the training, return to the lower life, enjoy wealth, make merit? This is the end of the quote. The Buddha, knowing that Sona was being gripped by doubt, went to talk to him. Sona had been an accomplished lute player, and the Buddha knew that if he talked to him through this experience to him, that he could reach him. So this is the way he speaks to Sona. Now, what do you think, Sona? Before, when you were a house dweller, were you skilled at playing the lute? Yes, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were too taut, was your lute in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were too loose, was your lute in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your lute were neither too taut nor too loose, but tuned to be right on pitch, was your lute in tune and playable? Yes, Lord. In the same way, Sona, over-aroused persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. Thus, you should determine the right pitch for your persistence. The analogy of the lute strings being too taut or too loose offer us a very clear image of the quality of our effort that we aim for in our practice. So we gradually learn to fine-tune our effort in our practice. And we know effort is the sixth step in the Noble Eightfold Path. We refer to it as right effort when we know how to find that wonderful middle way. I like also the example of a lute player, because it's very fitting for our practice of mindfulness. Sound and music exist only in the present. And as a musician, when you're tuning your instrument, you have to be precisely in the moment, completely aware of what the instrument is like in that moment, given the temperature, the humidity in the air, the dryness in the air, has to be tuned just right in that precise moment. And so exactly is with our body, mind, and heart. You know, think about the many, many variables that change from 1 hour to the next. How much we've eaten, are we rested, are we hot, are we cold, are we depressed, are we too excited, etc. So all these variables that we need to take into consideration, and then know what tool do we use to create that right effort. That's the trick. So if I may take the analogy of the musician even further, just like a lute player spends thousands of hours to apply right effort to learn to play, excuse me. So applying your effort as an artist, as a musician, for many, many hours, that brings you to the mastery, right? To the freedom that is so apparent in great artists. And so it is for us. We need to apply thousands of hours to train our mind. And we apply that effort to purify our minds to become free. Pablo Picasso said, "The purpose of art is washing the dust of daily life off of our souls. And what we do through meditation, mindfulness, and stilling the mind is a kind of a washing the obscurations of the mind so we can have a clear mind. And as our minds has moments of clarity, then we develop suppleness in the mind. There is loving kindness present, and we begin to have moments, we begin to taste moments of freedom. These moments of freedom lead towards befriending the inevitable suffering that comes with being alive. You know, what we call dukkha or suffering. You know, what we all encounter. Everyone. Aging, illness, death. And knowing that everything that is dear to us at some point will be separated from us. So we befriend dukkha or suffering, and we surrender to the reality of dukkha in life. We befriend also anicca, or impermanence. We recognize that everything is subject to change. There is a painting by the French painter Nicolas Poussin that I think is a very fine example of impermanence as an expression of Western art. The title alone is very interesting. It's called Dancing to the Music of Time. It depicts four people dancing in a circle. Each headpiece symbolizes a different state in human existence, such as wealth or poverty, which you can see it's already pointing in what in Buddhism we call the worldly winds, such as gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. So to me, this circle of dancers suggests the ever-changing facets and states of our life. So also around the dancers are various symbols of impermanence, such as one child blowing soap bubbles, another one holding a sand clock, and then an old man playing a lyre. All of these symbols pointing to the ephemeral transient nature of reality. So like the painting's title, our life is a dance to the music of time. We befriend anicca, or impermanence, and surrender to anicca. And I take it further with the analogy of the lute player. We all have, or I hope we all have had the experience in a live music performance when there is this sense of the artist really surrendering to the music. When this surrendering to the music is an act of humility, the self is momentarily suspended or arrested. And that's a very palpable moment for the audience, and it's a very exciting moment for the artist and for the audience. Thomas Merton said, "Art enables us to find ourselves and lose ourselves at the same time." So in our practice, as we continually apply wise effort and mindfulness, there comes a watershed moment in our experience when we ourselves experience this sense of I surrender. In that moment, we let go of micromanaging, because we finally recognize the burden of constructing the self, of propping up the self. So when we get to this recognition, we are able to surrender to a great space, a great space that opens in front of us, and something much, much larger than us and much larger than our rational mind leads us one step at a time. We don't really know where we're going, but we have the sense that we can trust this force, this strength that is leading us on. And then we discover that in this surrendered state, there's so much more energy, energy to be spontaneous, to be genuine, to laugh, to cry, and to play. I want to finish reading to you a poem by Hafez, the Persian poet from the 14th century. I'm taking the liberty of exchanging two words in the poem in order for it to fit in this context. So I'm exchanging the word saint for arahant, which means a liberated being, and I'm also exchanging the word God for the term ultimate truth. So the poem is called Tripping Over Joy. What is the difference between your experience of existence and that of an arahant? The arahant knows that the spiritual path is a sublime chess game with the ultimate truth, and that the beloved has just made such a fantastic move that the arahant is now continually tripping over joy and bursting out in laughter and saying, "I surrender." Whereas, my dear, I'm afraid you still think you have 1,000 serious moves. So let's take a moment to let the words in, and you might think about if there's some further thoughts you want to share, some questions you have in relation to surrender. So, and I'd like to hear from you your thoughts about surrendering, questions, comments.
Thank you. First, very timely for me. Mm-hmm. As you were talking, and actually earlier during the sitting, I was thinking about forgiveness. Mm. And I wonder if you might talk about the relationship between surrender, as you've beautifully laid out tonight, and forgiveness. Mm.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful question. I think before I say something, I'd like to hear from you. How do you see the connection? Because I have a sense that you already have a feeling for how the two come together.
I think I was thinking in a large global sense about forgiving myself for many actions that that I regret, specifically all the terrible things that I've eaten in my life. And so earlier I was thinking about the tremendous difficulty involved in all the different forms of forgiveness, the forgiveness of trespasses, in particular of one person against another, and then seeing that as a that there's always also the issue of one's own actions as being a trespass against oneself. And then, of course, that's oneself. So that has all the issues of selfness beautiful. Running around.
So, were you going to add something? So what would you say you're surrendering to in order to get to forgiveness?
I think that's what I need help with.
Yeah. I think that with a lot of compassion, you know, if we can surrender to knowing that we're not perfect, you know, to surrender to our imperfections. And with a lot of compassion, just know that and set the intention to do the best you can, one step at a time. But definitely forgive yourself. No, that's an important piece. Not forgiving ourselves is just, you know, continuing to carry this burden that really doesn't help anybody. That's a lovely thing about the practice, you know, that it encourages us to see where we went wrong. You investigate it kindly, you learn from it, and then you let it go, or you surrender to it, you forgive yourself, and you go on. And I think it's so wonderful to know. Yeah, it doesn't help me, it doesn't help anybody else to continue flagellating myself that I did something wrong. You know, there comes a little bit of mental discipline to just say, no, I'm not going to go there anymore. I learned what I had to learn. I'm going to do my best. We go on.
So at one level, it sounded to me in what you just said that surrender and forgiveness are all wound up in one another.
They're not the same thing, but they're definitely related, right? So when we surrender, it's very easy to offer ourselves forgiveness. And we surrender to our imperfections, to the recognition of our imperfections in a kind way without beating ourselves up for it. And then there is the forgiveness which moves us forward. So that's what I wish for you.
Mm. as you were speaking a moment ago, you mentioned letting go, which is maybe a synonym. For me, I like it to describe it better that way. I'm reminded of something Joseph Goldstein has frequently, I've heard him say it, and he's frequently quoted as having said it, that to know the mind, you have to study it. And that's the practice, studying the mind. And as you do that, you begin to know how it works. You see the habits of the mind and how the habits of the mind create habits of body. And then you see the illusory nature, the delusions that we have about how we control things.
Yeah.
And when you see that, they're easy to let go. And until you actually see it, you're just making yourself let go of things that you don't think are useful, but you don't really know. In that case, it's punishment to let go of things that you don't really want to give up.
Right.
Things that you're letting go of because you've seen the harm they do you or the uselessness are easy to let go of.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you should touch upon the question of letting go versus surrender, because I questioned myself this before, and I'm curious. I don't have the answer yet. I kind of have a sense, but I'd like to ask you all, do you think it's the same thing, letting go and surrendering? And if not, why? What is the difference? Yeah, do you want to pass the microphone back there?
I think it's really interesting to reflect on just the even as you were talking, surrender, like just how that looks in my practice and I guess the feeling quality of it, like when I kind of reflect in my life and moments I have felt surrender and then talking about letting go. I'm not sure. I think that sometimes, you know, maybe a little of both qualities are present in my experience. But I think when I think about letting go, sometimes, at least for me, there's an effort made in actually allowing myself to have some ease or kind of maybe loosening in a way, like seeing that there's resistance or tension and there's effort in letting go, either in my mind or in my body or emotionally. And when I feel surrender, it's more of, I don't know, an abiding in what's happening or like kind of like offering myself, like I feel like I see myself like offering myself to like whatever's happening and like kind of abiding in it and not having, I guess not, there's not the effort of release. There's not the consciousness of there's tension and there's release. There's like when I surrender, I'm like fuck it a little bit, like oh, you know, and like and then I'm like I let the stream take me, and at least that's my mind and what I say, and it, I usually have these kind of moments, and when I let this stream take me, there's it's like for a while at least when I'm in that feeling of surrender, like really like. Kind of, it feels powerful when I let the stream take me, it just takes me.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of resistance.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's kind of my reflections, and there's a different energy to it in my inner experience. So.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think that letting go and surrendering has a, if you just feel it in your body, I don't want to say it myself, I'd love to hear it from you. Do you want to give it a try? I saw you nodding, so. Thank you.
Let's see. I can't hear it. I think the word abiding is really close to it. Like, it's in the body. Like, when I think about surrender, it's just like there's no effort involved. It's not like, oh, what's happening? It's like, oh, I'll let it pass me. It's more like, oh, this is what's happening. It's like a complete surrender. Like,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. I say surrender, but it's like I'm trying to describe. But it's like, you know, it's this.
Yeah, it's something very bodily, right? I mean, where would you pick, if you had to pick the core of surrendering in your body, where would it be?
For me, it's like it's either in the heart or in the gut, you know, like, or like
it's
even
like
the
really
head.
Really central, it's like, right?
Yeah.
Really central. And letting go, for me, it could be here, you know. It could be, so it's a little bit more detached. Surrendering is from the core. It just, there's something that caves in, because very physical.
Yeah. It's like falling apart. You can't control falling apart. Yeah. Like things fall apart.
See, you're using the word fall again.
Yeah.
Yeah? Falling apart, falling asleep, falling in love. You know, is that collapsing. But can we find the joy of collapsing? You know, like how Hafiz talks about it. It's in a tripping with joy, which I find so charming.
We laugh at others when we watch Americans, you know, funniest home videos, people falling.
Yeah. Anybody else wants to give it a try or has another view, comment?
So I have another comment, question. I am a neophyte to the practice. Mm. This is relatively new for me. But I feel as though I'm beginning to experience the joy and happiness and lack of suffering through the practice. And I come from a tradition of Christianity where when you talk about surrendering, my understanding of it, you're surrendering to God. Mm-hmm. You're surrendering to a God. And as we know him. And here, my senses, and perhaps why I find this fulfilling or more beneficial, is I feel like through the practice, I'm surrendering to myself. I'm surrendering, I mean, almost to the practice, but I'm letting go. Again, maybe this gets back to the letting go. I'm just wondering, again, not that we're trying to compare and contrast, but just conceptually, am I on track with that?
I think it's lovely what you said about surrendering to yourself. Surrendering to ourself is like coming home. It's the same path as surrendering to the ultimate truth or what really is in the moment. That's what we are practicing for. Can we put, you know, our little contracted self to one side and just, okay, this is what's real for me now. It just, there's such a relief when we can do that. It takes time, though. You know, it definitely takes time, and we have to be patient. But I think what you said is so true, that no matter how short of time you've been practicing, you do begin to see the and taste this moment of more freedom. You know, on this. And the spectrum, if we can all remember the way it was when we were adolescents and we couldn't think of anything else but how do I look and how is the other looking at me and how, what do they think about me and everything is about me. No, it's such suffering. As we grow older, that helps a lot. You know, that kind of begins to weaken some. But the practice really has so much, it's just so much wisdom, and everything is structured for us in a method of how to deconstruct this structure that we constantly, constantly prop up. You know, in the way we dress, that we talk, we move, we...
That last question and your story earlier reminds me of the truth, the insight of the truth of the first noble truth,
mm-hmm.
And the meaning of the truth of suffering, knowing that there is suffering. Whatever we do, they're suffering.
Mm.
It's unavoidable. And it doesn't happen because of anything we do or anything we didn't do. And there's a surrendering in that.
Yeah.
That's the surrender, letting, and I prefer to call it letting go. But,
Yeah, lovely. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that reminds me of the question that you asked back there, you know, that aspect of forgiveness and surrendering. If we keep in mind the fact of the first noble truth, that helps enormously. Yeah, there's nothing, so often there's nothing that we did wrong. It's just part of the reality of being human. Suffering is part of being human. So then when suffering comes, there's not such a added layer of, oh, what did I do wrong, and why me? No, so it's just, okay, there's just there's suffering now, and that's part of life. It's part of first noble truth. And then this wonderful invitation of, okay, now investigate. Investigate the causes. You know, that's so empowering, and anybody who is curious and likes to study, I think, gets very enthusiastic about this invitation. Yeah, I don't have to just fold in, cave in, and you know, suffer, but okay, look at it, you know, what are the causes? And then there's a hope. Yeah, there is an end. You can find the end of suffering. And then finally, and here is the path how to find the end of suffering. So it's always very encouraging to find somebody who's new to the practice and who can share that there is already a discovery, a sense that there is less suffering that we are creating for ourselves. Would you like to add something?
Guess you could just tell, huh?
Yes.
Thank you for your talk. It was lovely.
You're welcome.
I'm going to use the word feel,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned the gut, and in reference to what you said, I think the letting go can be a very mental construct. You can mentally, as a kind of thought or intellectual process, I think you can let go of something. But to truly surrender, as you touched upon with Toll, is we are creatures of consciousness, and at the moment, and you can talk a lot about the gut and learning to trust your gut as it's in tune to like the cosmic energy or whatever you like to call it, where you realize at that moment, wow, I can't control any of this, and it's total acceptance, I think, as he alluded to, acceptance of now and and the universe and life itself. And when you say, you know, fuck it, I can't control any of it, it's just what's supposed to be, I think that's where the divide is, at least the way, after listening to everyone here talk about it.
what I just was able to put together here. So thank you all for sharing. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of those questions that is just wonderful to keep in mind, and we don't have to answer it in a definite way, but just live with it and look at it yourself. You know, look at it in your experience directly, not thinking about it, but in your experience. How does it feel? Am I letting go? How does it feel? Is this surrendering? Is this letting go? And one day, as Rilke says, you might live into the answer. So it's 9:00. Thank you very much.